You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. A few years ago, Peter Sagal, the quick-witted host of NPR's popular Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, hit the road on a customized red, white, and blue Harley Davidson.
Those patriotic colors on the Harley spoke to his mission. He wanted to ride across the country to find out if the U.S. Constitution was still alive and well in America, 225 years after its founding.
Sagal covered more than 2,000 miles by motorbike to find out how the Constitution lived on in America's towns and cities. He recently sat down with Rob Ferret, who asked him why anyone would ride around on a Harley asking people about the Constitution.
There's been an awful lot of talk about the Constitution in the last few years. And although these days you hear a lot of it from the right wing or half of society, that the Constitution is being violated or the constitutional principles are being lost, during the prior presidential administration, you heard it from the left side of society. A lot of people invoking the Constitution, saying the Constitution says this, the Constitution shouldn't allow this, this, be what it may, is unconstitutional. And, you know, to paraphrase that old joke about the weather, everybody complains about the Constitution, but nobody does anything about it. Or more to the point, it seems nobody really talks about the Constitution as it is being lived today. And what I mean by that is a lot of times when people invoke the Constitution, and again, both sides do this, they refer to its original meaning, you know. This is particularly true among the Tea Party set, but it's not exclusive to them. They say, you know, our founders never intended for X to be allowed, or our founders believed that Y was the most important thing.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody talks about it as it's alive today. The founders are dead and buried, as wonderful as they were. And for many, many years, 226 to be exact, since the Constitution was ratified, we, the American people, have in successive generations been living out this Constitution in our own way. It has changed radically, not just the text through amendment, but our understanding of it. And even as we speak, it is surrounding us. It is binding us together. My joke is it's like the Force. And what we, and by that I mean myself and the producers of this documentary that I did for PBS last year, wanted to find out was how is it being lived now? And what we did was we took that motorcycle, that 2013 Road King, and we rode around the country and we talked to people who, through intentionally or not, were caught up in constitutional issues, including perhaps most famously at this point, a woman named Chris Perry and her partner Sandy Steer, who were the lead plaintiffs in the case that eventually went to the Supreme Court under the name Hollingsworth v. Perry and became part of the recent jurisprudence establishing in many states, increasing number of states, a right to same-sex marriage, you know. So these are people who were making a claim. We think that the Constitution allows this. And it went right to the Supreme Court. So, you know, for these people and many people like them in different issues, the Constitution is not just a historical document you can see under glass in Washington. It is alive and well and active. And that's what we wanted to talk about.
Even these people caught up in it, though, do they just see this as a legal issue, a legal matter, or do they feel the Force, to run with your metaphor? Do they feel the
absolutely.
Constitution as a living thing?
You know, this is you have to understand, for the living Constitution is a term of art that refers to a particular kind of argument. And so I tried to avoid that phrase, although I think it has a lot of truth to it. What I ended up thinking about and talking about a lot is the Constitution is a centerpiece of a civic religion. And what I mean by that is through an analogy to, say, a certain kind of Christian. Or for any religion, but let's take, just for the sake of argument, a Christian. You might run into somebody who calls themselves a Christian, but if you talk to them about biblical texts, about the history of the church, about the Gospels, the Gnostic Gospels, you know, all the stuff, they may not know any of that. They may not know their text. But they live, this person we're talking about, according to the principles of Christianity as they understand them, which they feel very strongly about. And these may be like, you know, love thy neighbor and turn the other cheek and do charitable works. You can't say that person isn't a Christian because they don't know the works of St. Augustine, for example. Similarly, our country is filled with people, the vast majority of us, who may not know constitutional texts or jurisprudence, who may not know about even Brown v. Board, let alone much more obscure but important cases like the slaughterhouse cases in the 19th century. But they firmly believe that the Constitution guarantees rights, it confers obligations. It means that if we have a dispute, we settle it through legal matters or through elections, not through force of arms. And at first, I thought that people were woefully ignorant, that they didn't know about things like, Griswold v. Connecticut or stuff like that, or Loving v. Virginia, important Supreme Court cases. By the end of the process, I began to really appreciate the fact that what motivates and sort of illuminates this country is that religion, that religious belief in the Constitution and the rights it guarantees. So I think it's more that. They believe in the Constitution as a force in its own good that preserves and protects this country, and I think they're right.
Well, the world is packed with constitutions that were lovely on paper.
Exactly.
And failed in a year to a decade. Is it because they didn't have that lived belief in them, that civic religion acceptance?
Yes. As a matter of fact, one of the more interesting things that was said to me by a noted constitutional scholar. He said, the Soviet Union had a constitution, had a Bill of Rights. And it did. It did. I looked it up. It was a really good one. I mean, it had things in it that would really satisfy just about anybody who was looking for a really well-made government. It guaranteed people all kinds of rights, the right to speech, the right to assembly, the right to forward unions, the freedom of conscience. It also guaranteed them health care and education. It was awesome. It described a utopia. And as we all know, it was a sick, cruel joke played on the people of the Soviet Union for, 80 years. It was a nightmare. It wasn't worth the trees they cut down to print it. So why,
Yeah.
Why did the Soviet Union Bill of Rights was a meaningless joke, and why is ours more or less worked as designed? And it really comes down to that common belief. It has to do with the fact that everybody in this country, from you and me all the way up to the president, believes in this Constitution and will act in its precepts. And if it is violated, we will agree to correct that eventually. Again, I don't want to look at our history through rose-tinted glasses. Mm-hmm. There have been intense struggles, painful struggles that cost people their lives to make the Constitution live up to its own promises. But nonetheless, the progress and the reality has been toward making it work. And it's because of that religion, because ultimately we all believe in it, however much we might disagree on its, shall we say, its particulars.
All right. I hate to just keep asking why, but why did we believe in it? Was it something that the founders did? Is it something about the nature of Americans, the weather? I don't know.
It's a really good question. I mean, and it's sort of, you keep ending up, just being circular. People believe in it because they believe in it. And one of the more amazing things that we witnessed when we made this documentary, and it made it into the documentary, I'm glad to say, is a citizenship ceremony, mm-hmm. a naturalization ceremony, that's the phrase. And, this was just like the ceremony that my ancestors did when they came here from Russia and Germany at the turn of the last century. That might have happened at a terminal in Philadelphia or Ellis Island or Boston, wherever they landed. Today it was this year, it was in Chicago, and it was in a federal building downtown. And unlike, they weren't, Polish and Russian Jews, as my ancestors were, or Irish people or Italian people. These happened to be Mexicans or Somalis. A smattering of Europeans, Eastern Europe in particular, a lot of South Americans, Caribbean people. And, this incredible diverse melange of people and languages and ethnicities. And they all, at the end of that ceremony, were as American as you or I or anybody born here or how my ancestors became after they became citizens. And you really have to ask, what makes these people Americans? There's no shared cultural heritage, right? Like people talk about the shared cultural heritage of, say, Japan or Russia. People talk about, the cultural tradition of the autocratic strongman in Russia, which is why democracy has such a problem there. Or democracy in Switzerland, right? We don't have that. We're from all over the place. My ancestors probably didn't have anything in common with yours. They had nothing in common with the Somali people who just became citizens. But what we have in common is this new, again, I'll use the phrase, civic religion that everybody swears allegiance to, saying, I believe in the principles of democracy as laid out in the Declaration of Independence, that every person, we no longer say man, has certain rights from God or wherever, that those rights won't be abrogated, that we have the right to self-government. that there is a right to redress in the courts if a wrong has done us, that we have the rights to form and unform governments of our own will, that we are committed to this very messy, sometimes very unsatisfactory and inefficient democracy, no matter its costs. And they all buy it. They all accept the gift of freedom in exchange for responsibility to be citizens. They know that part of the responsibility, again, is that if you get angry at your neighbor, you don't shoot him. You take him to court, you know, or if there's a problem, you call the police, that we will participate from the bottom up. And if we didn't, if enough people gave up on it, it would fall apart. The Constitution, I mean, one of the things I pointed out to people is a lot of people say, well, the Constitution prevents, take an example, Obamacare, or the Constitution prevents background checks for assault weapons or whatever. And whenever anybody says that argument to me, and I got a lot of emails like this, well, don't you see that the Constitution clearly says this? I'd say, great, you're right. What are you going to do about it? I mean, you could be right, say. I mean, here's an argument that was actually made to me, so I'll use this one, that the Air Force is unconstitutional.
Because the word Air Force isn't in the Constitution.
Exactly. It says Navy and Army. It says nothing about an Air Force. Now, nobody serious makes this argument because it's obvious that armed forces is implied, a level of technology at the time, whatever. But you can say to this guy or anybody with any similar argument, great, you're right. The Constitution's the Air Force is unconstitutional. What are you going to do about it? Because, as I said to him, and I'll say to anybody else, the Constitution itself is four pieces of parchment, the original version of which is sitting in the National Archives under glass. And you're asserting, even arguing successfully, that thing X, the Air Force, is unconstitutional, is not going to suddenly make that document fly up out of its case like bat wings, go over to the president and bat him about the head until he disbands the Air Force, right? It's just parchment. If you have a convincing argument about what the Constitution says or should say, you have to convince your fellow citizens, enough of them, to change our government so that that change goes into effect. Good luck to you. That's the burden of democracy. And so, I mean, that's what it takes. There's a real obligation to engage, and that's what we all believe in.
That's Peter Sagal, host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, talking about his cross-country trip on a Harley-Davidson motorcycle to find out what the U.S. Constitution means to Americans 225 years after its founding. We'll hear more from Peter in a minute.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're listening to Peter Sagal, host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, sharing stories from his cross-country motorbike trip to see how the U.S. Constitution lives in America today. Rob Ferret asked him what aspects of the Constitution people are most passionate about.
For most people, and I think this is human, they're passionate about the thing that they care about, the particular fruit of liberty that they like the flavor of, if you can follow that metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
So people are most passionate about the Constitution when they feel it guarantees them a right for something they want to do, be it carry around an AK-47 or marry their same-sex partner. You know, there are people, and I love these people, who get very excited about the Constitution in the abstract. And a lot of those people end up being lawyers and scholars of the Constitution, and civic-minded activists. They join the ACLU. They might join other legal organizations or advocacy organizations in order to preserve that. But usually it's for a goal. It's because they want our society to reflect a value that they believe in. And that's fine. I have no problem with that because the Constitution doesn't solve our arguments. It makes our arguments possible in a civic way. That's what it's about. It's about you with your passion arguing profoundly that our society should be shaped in a certain way, and me, assuming I disagree, arguing passionately on the other side, actively engaged in politics and civic life so that one of us will win or will compromise and society will change. That's what the Constitution gives us. It doesn't give us the answers. It gives us a way, no matter how imperfect, to settle the question.
A rule book to settle the problems.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you played Dungeons and Dragons where you're going up like I did.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, did I?
We're in public radio. Yes. That can be expected. Well, if you remember, I never come up with this metaphor, but I like it. Dungeons and Dragons, for those who had normal childhoods playing sports and going outside, is a game that is an open-ended game that you play, you sit around, you play with your friends, and you have this adventure, this made-up adventure. And what the rule book does is it gives you ways to settle disputes, right? Mm-hmm. In this case, the disputes are sword fights or magic spell fights or whatever.
Do I successfully whack the dragon?
Exactly. I'm going to whack the dragon, right? So it's basically, Dungeons & Dragons doesn't tell you what kind of adventure you're going to have. It tells you how you're going to have it. Similarly, the game masters, if you will, the guys who wrote the rules in the Constitution 225 years ago, 226 years ago, didn't know what our national adventure would be. They didn't know where we would go, what we would do, what kind of country we would become, whether we would become an empire or an isolationist country. What they didn't have any idea, mm-hmm. I think, how big it would become physically or in terms of population. What they gave us was a rule book to play this game, here's an old school callback, to choose our own adventure, if you will. And following the rules is really important because if you break the rules, you can't continue the game, right? If you're playing Dungeons & Dragons and somebody stands up and says, I don't care that I just rolled a one, I still killed him. Well, the game ends, right? Mm-hmm. You have to have the rules to play the game. Similarly, you know, and that to a certain extent was what started the Civil War.
Right. They said, we're going to take our dice and go home.
Go home. I mean, I don't know if I've ever compared to the Confederate, anybody has ever compared to the Confederate South in the Civil War to Dungeons and Dragons, but that's essentially what happened. The problem with the Civil War, at least to begin with, wasn't slavery, although obviously that was the underlying cause. It was that there was a national presidential election that happened according to the rules, and the losing side said, fine, we didn't win, we're leaving. That's why it was such an affront to democracy, because the central idea of democracy is no matter what happens, you follow the rules, in this case, the Constitution. No matter what the result, even if you don't like it, sorry, that's the rules, that's the game, try again next time.
Every now and then I'll get a press release from somebody saying our state should secede or it's time for a new civil war for one reason or another. Do you worry that in our lifetimes, even, somebody else might want to take the dice and go home and say, you know what, the rule book doesn't work anymore?
There will be people who say that. There will always be people who say that. Do I worry that it will ever happen? Well, even though I have read a lot of apocalyptic science fiction growing up, you know, Canticle for Leibowitz, anyone?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. You and
great
I,
book.
Man.
Yeah. Let's hang out sometime.
Yeah, I know. Hey. Anyway, even though I've read a lot of apocalyptic science fiction growing up and read a lot of scenarios in which the country breaks up, to this day, as you know, there are people who want to break up California or secede from Texas or mm-hmm. whatevs. I don't think it's going to happen because the tendency of society as our population grows, as our technology improves, is that we are more and more and more and more and more and more interconnected. So, you know, let's take these guys, these wonderful people in Texas who say we should secede, you know, from the United States. Really? Do you want to have borders on all, and I speak roughly here, four sides of your state? Do you want to have to, like, change currency when you drive into Oklahoma? Really? Do you want to have to pay a customs fee when you buy something from Amazon because they're based in Seattle? I mean, you know, it's all nonsense. And the forces holding us together, not only, you know, politics, but commerce and communication and family ties, highways, infrastructure, everything in this country are so profound that if these people ever actually tried to take their flapping lips and make them into policy, they'd run into the reality of the country we live in, which is that we're deeply interconnected. And always will be, because that's where we get so much of our strength and privilege as Americans.
One of the amazing things to me anyway is that we're pretty much using that first run with a handful of amendments. I think Thomas Jefferson said, hey, you guys are going to have to rewrite this thing, you know, pretty often, 7 years or something like that. Why don't we do that? Why haven't we amended it more?
That's a good question. You make a good point. A historian of the Constitutional Convention who we talked to in the documentary said that these guys thought that maybe this would last 50 or 60 years maximum, this country they were building. I mean, they had seen so much change in their own lifetimes, let alone the massive change of the revolution and independence itself. There's something we mentioned in the documentary, that our Constitution, the American Constitution, is the longest active written constitution in the world. There are other ones, but none go back as far. And it is also the shortest by a lot. And that is really related. And I think the reason the Constitution has lasted so long is it is because it is so short. And what I mean by that is that the founders had the wisdom and the foresight not to lock us into too much stuff, right?
Ah, so we can fill in the blanks a little.
Exactly. They don't, for example, tell us what kind of welfare programs we should have. They don't tell us what kind of laws about what tax rates we should have, right? They don't tell us hardly any of the daily political decisions that a country makes. They say, here's the framework, you guys figure it out, speaking to posterity. A lot of constitutions that have been written since then fill in a lot of those blanks. They call for universal health care. We went to Iceland to talk to the people who were writing a new constitution there, which has since been rejected. And they had a ball. They wrote in all kinds of fun stuff. Not only national health care and retirement insurance, but also laws pertaining to the welfare of animals. They were going to make it part of their national constitution. They couldn't be mean to animals. Now, I'm all for being nice to animals. I think that's a good thing, personally. But I'm really glad that our founders didn't write that or any of those other things into the Constitution. They left it to us. If we wanted to, we could pass a law as a nation making the slaughter of animals for meat illegal. We could do that. We're not gonna. We could. And then we can undo it if such time as we all get hungry for a burger. And that's the genius, that they didn't decide any of those issues for us. They let us decide. And that is why I think it's lasted so long.
Peter, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, and I hope to see people tomorrow in Milwaukee at the Harley-Davidson Museum.
That was Peter Sagal, host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, talking to Rob Ferret. Peter Sagal will be at the Harley-Davidson Museum in Milwaukee tomorrow, as he said, to tell more Constitution stories. Find more information at harleydavidson.com or a link on our Facebook page. I got a picture of her.